Right, well, what's the date? The 30th of November, 1992. 8 o'clock. Tire feather Craig Meesh. Marcy's sitting on the settee with us. All ready for a big play. And I'm talking to Annie about Mona Douglas. So, Annie, when did you first meet Mona? How old were you?
I think I was about 7 or maybe 8 at the most. 7, I think. This was at Eglach Fanon, Tai Eglach Fanon, which is in Mount Havelock and Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was number 1 Mount Havelock, the building. And I went along with my mother and father and my sister, Jenny, to go to the Eglach Fanon, which was the children's Manx cultural organisation, I suppose, at the time. We didn't know a lot about it then, we just had heard that it was where you could find out little bits about Manx songs and dances.
Where about it did you hear about it? Remember?
Yes, my mother had gone to a Manx class which was held by the Board of Education in those days in Lord Street, and occasionally I used to go along with her, just to sit there once or twice, though I didn't really understand what was all the Manx. And Leslie Quirk either was at the classes or did some of the classes, and he suggested to Mum that this would be, seeing me there, that this would be a suitable thing for me to go to and I might find it interesting. So, because he knew Mona Douglas and he knew the sort of things that were there, so mother and father thought it would be reasonable to take me along, and it was Saturday night as well, so it was quite suitable. So anyway, that's how I first met Mona Douglas. I turned up at one of these Saturday night or Saturday evening things at Mount Havelock.
Yeah. Can you describe what it was like inside? How you got there? Or what, even whereabouts it was?
Yes, it was number 1 Mount Havelock, and it was before all the houses that had been were knocked down, the ones that were knocked down to clear the way for the back of government office. And it was the first one. It was had a large cellar beneath. You could see the top of the cellar from the road, and there were three huge stone steps to get up to there. I don't know who on earth ever put steps like that up. They're extremely difficult for a child to get up, and I would have thought impossible for anybody who had any problems in moving very easily. And there was a wooden door, and the floor was long floorboards inside, all sagging in the middle, and there was a long sort of rectangular room, not really much bigger than somebody's living room, and in one corner there was a tap where the water for the kettle was kept. Mona would periodically make tea and nearly electrocute herself because she never bothered about things like having safe electrical elements and things, and there was always flashes and things coming out of the kettles, and there was always terrible noises like cows shouting coming out of the water whenever she switched the tap on. There was that was in one corner. There was water coming through the roof on the far end, and that was dripping onto the piano, which was a very old one, and half the notes didn't work. The windows along one side, and underneath those there were all settees, all very old settees and chairs that looked like they'd been thrown out of various people's houses, and that's where everybody would sit when they weren't dancing or singing or whatever. So altogether it was quite a strange sort of building. It sounds a bit bleak, but it could fill up with quite a lot of people, and you'd still have little do's there, like the Melia and this sort of thing, Christmas do's, and it would fill up with people, and it would seem quite cheerful. You'd decorate it up if there was anything on, like a Melia, it would all have the windows all covered with different things from the hedgerows and things like that, so it could look quite nice.
Yeah. And was there any posters or anything on the wall, or writing or anything?
Yes, there was a big, I come to think about it, on one wall there was a great big painted wooden, it was like a wooden banner really, a very large thing, about 8 foot long and a few foot high, which was painted red and it had gold letters on saying Pech and Jew Ashun Merech. And that was the motto of Eglachvan. This room was also used by Mekvan at some point, so I'm not sure that some of the things that were seen were not actually Mekvan's. Oh, and there were lots and lots of black and white photographs of various members of Eglachvan at various times. I remember seeing there's a photo of some people in the outside the Vilmarine in the 1930s, a dance group, that was Eglachvan then, and various people. I think there was somebody doing the dance of the Rinkrich and Vannen dance, the sword dance. It's a pic, I think this is Billy, somebody who Mona used to talk about, who danced in the 50s, and various black and white photos of different people over a quite long stretch of time who'd all been in Eglach Vannen.
So how long had it been going, Eglach Vannen, do you know?
No, I don't know, but I would guess it had probably been going for about 50 years or so before I joined, just from looking at the photos and from talking to...
And you joined in about 1969, or earlier?
Earlier than that, about 65, 66, something like that.
And how many people used to go to Eglach Vannen when you were there?
Well, when I first went, there were a fair number of children and teenagers, more teenagers really than children, often families, and there were quite a lot of boys going, surprisingly, and Mona more or less went out and picked people off the street if she heard them shouting outside or playing outside the window. She would say, why don't you come in? And sometimes they would for a joke or for a sort of dare with their friends, and they would stay. So there was about, when I started, there would be about 16 or so people all doing, coming fairly regularly, and then there were other people who would drift out, in and out. But in about 10 years after that, it sort of dwindled down to a sort of half a dozen people, maybe.
Yeah. And there's quite a few people who've gone on from Eglach Vannen, who are now quite active in the language and cultural movement, is that right?
Yes, I believe so. I believe Bernard Kane was a member of Eglach Vannen, I believe, but I haven't heard him say that Brian Stoll was too. And various other people, I believe. So I don't know, but I suspect some present MHKs as well have had some connections at some point, whether they were in Eglach Vannen or just a friend of Mona's, I don't know. But,
and Eglach Vannen, they used to do concerts. Could you tell me a bit about the concerts you used to do?
Yes, it was a bit like a travelling concert party of children, really. Mona seemed to know an awful lot of people in various organisations, churches, chapels, various things, and they would occasionally ask her to put on some Manx entertainment of an evening. So basically she would bring up the group of children around to different places on the island. It would be church halls, and it might be chapels or whatever, and we'd perform songs and dances, the ones we'd learned, and occasionally we'd do an odd play. I remember doing one at the old St Andrew's Church, where the hall was. It's now demolished. There was a little theatre. We did a few plays and things there. I don't think the entertainment was of a terribly high standard, it must be admitted, and I think it was probably amusing for people, some of it, but we were often doing dances and you hadn't a clue how they finished, or half the people had never done them before, or you'd be singing songs and only one person really knew it and the others were all standing there sort of mimicking. But Mona didn't seem to mind, as long as you did it, and she didn't worry too much. whether people thought it was good, bad, or indifferent. And I suppose it's quite easy to be overcritical of yourself looking back. Yes, we did a fair amount of going around the island doing concerts and all sorts of things, or being part of somebody else's concerts. Yes.
And you tell me as well you used to do fencing.
Oh, yes. I don't quite know what was the point of the fencing, other than Mona's friend, Baron Giovanelli, was interested in fencing, and also Jack Irving was interested in fencing, and they seem to have acquired the foils and things and masks from somewhere. And when I joined, after all the Manx things, there was always fencing, though no reason was ever given to me quite why, whether it was to defend the nation with the foils, I don't know, but everybody had a go if they wanted to, and yes, I had a go too. I quite enjoyed it. Every time, if you jumped up and down too much, the floor heaved up and down. It was a bit hazardous, and owing to the girth of some of the people involved in the fencing, I sometimes wondered if they'd end up in the cellar below. No names mentioned.
There's a particular song that you kept telling me about. Could you tell me about that?
Oh yes, this was a song that always caused great secret mirth amongst all the children, mainly on account of the words, and the rather stirring patriotic tune, which always made everybody want to laugh somehow in the way of stirring patriotic tunes. Yes, Children of a Northern Isle. Yes, do you want me to sing it? I'll sing the first bit. Right. Children of a Northern Isle, hardy Manx are we. Da 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 da. That's a piano. Not for us the lotus lands, soft in luxury. Da 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 da. Viking blood is in our veins, Celtic fire and pride. We would sail a seas of life, even as proud vessels ride. Out in the stormy weather, that's where we choose to be, breasting the hills together, sailing the tossing sea, taking our share of hardship, fighting our own way through. That is the way our fathers lived, that's what we always want to do. And so it went on like that. Very stirring.
Well, Masty the cat is very impressed with that, I must say. He's perked up no end. Anyway, so you were saying that wasn't the only song that was written for Aglaif Banner.
Oh, such. Goodness me, no. No. But the main point of the thing was not to sing those sorts of songs. It was to sing the authentic songs. The Gaelic songs, some at Mona collected and some other ones. Most of the time was spent in learning those and singing those, and learning some of the dances and performing those as well, and learning little bits of Manx. We always had to say the Lord's Prayer in Manx every week. This is one reason why I know it backwards, I think. And most of the things we did were quite sensible or serious, I suppose, but there were abusing sides to it, like that was viewed the song rather amusement, but we didn't sing it very often, it must be said.
And was there any what you would call inter-Celtic involvement with Aglaif Annan on the island as such?
Yes, I think this was the first the first contact I really ever had with the rest of the Celtic world, or the first time I was really aware of there being such a thing as a sort of inter-Celticism going on, was through Eglur Fanon. Periodically, Mona would invite various people from Ireland or Wales to the island. They were obviously friends who she'd known before, but they always seemed to be people involved with radio or television or writing or something like that. And frequently the people would come and record and ask questions and then informally talk about situations in their own countries, which was quite a revelation to me as a child. It was very interesting. Indeed, it was through Mona Douglas and Eglur Fanon that I ended up going to the first inter-Celtic festival, not the first festival, one of the inter-Celtic festivals in Lorient in Brittany, I think, the first year. I was sent there. I was actually still an Eglur fan, and then Mona Douglas had been supposed to be going herself, but she decided at the last minute that it would be more beneficial for a younger person to go. So I ended up going myself, singing and dancing there. But certainly Eglur fan was a very good way of becoming aware of inter-Celticism. And Mona herself talked always in terms of sort of rather mystical terms of Celtic lands and peoples and their languages, and I know she had spent quite a bit of time certainly in Ireland and also in other Celtic countries, I believe.
That's very interesting. Now, I believe that you were in quite a fortunate position that you were asked to a lot of Mona's parties while you were an Eglur Fanon. Is that right? And were you the only Eglur Fanon member to get invited to these parties, or?
Well, no, I wasn't the only member. Claire Stone, who's now Claire Kilgallen, would come too, but mainly the sort of parties Mona would have were mainly for adults at the time. I suppose we were teenagers.
Early teens?
Yes, well, I can't remember, really early, I think. But we would certainly go, and we would. The idea of Mona's parties, they were Guinness, she always called them Guinness. They were never Cayley's or parties, it was a Guinness. And she would hope that the people would entertain and sing and do whatever they could. Some of them did, some of them couldn't, and some of them didn't. Mona herself would sing, it prevailed upon, in rather a quiet, quite an interesting sort of voice. She would sing. Bernard Cain would sing and play the whistle. Charles Gard would sometimes be prevailed upon to sing and play the harp, mostly to play the harp. And Gwyn Price would always be guaranteed to sing rousing Welsh songs and choruses, and always seemed to be enjoying himself tremendously. And there's been dancing up there, even in the garden at the back. There isn't a lot of room, there have been people dancing, and yes, there's been quite a lot of parties there, Guinness, that I enjoyed, and Mona herself certainly enjoyed being hospitable, and there was always lots of homemade food and drink going around.
This was at Mona's house, wasn't it?
Yes, up Ballarach, a very attractive house, I think, myself, very unusual, not a conventional sort of cottage. I believe it was built by her father, but there's a very, very large staircase, very, very wide at the bottom, as befitted a grander house, really. And there was a nice sitting room, really, with big pictures on the walls and a piano, and there was no wasted space. Everywhere was full of books, bookcases, and crowded with books, and paintings all hanging all over the place. Old paintings and sometimes more modern looking paintings. Every bit of space was crammed with things which to me looked very interesting and showed the signs of somebody who read a lot and thought a lot, not just about Manx things and Gaelic Celtic things, but about all sorts of things, religion and philosophy and different parts of the world, all manner of things.
When you actually, when did you actually leave Glockfannon? Was this when you went away, or?
Yes, when I went to university. But prior to the 2 years prior to that, there'd only been a handful of children, well, teenagers, going along to Glockfannon. But Mona was not despondent about that, because she felt that the work of Glockfannon was by then being reasonably well taken up by teachers in a lot of the schools. The Cruinneach was starting to show signs of happening. So she didn't see herself in the role of a teacher. She always thought that trained teachers could do the job of passing on music and dancing better than she could, as far as actual teaching things were concerned. She wasn't big-headed or felt she should have the monopoly of things, so she was quite happy to let Glockfannon sort of fade out gradually, because she felt she'd fulfilled a purpose at the time when it was needed. But that its time had passed, and that Manx things were spreading much more quickly than they had at any other time in her lifetime, and that she felt a lot more optimistic about the future. So, whereas we'd meet with Mona to learn an odd new song or dance, or to practice a play or something like that, there was no real attempt to sort of keep Glockfannon going to the end. It phased out. It didn't sort of suddenly stop 1 week. It sort of phased out naturally as we all got older and went off our different ways. But we still kept in touch with Mona, obviously, for many years after that, as adults.
Of course, I suppose, for Mona, by the time that you're talking about, things were happening quite a bit. When she started off, they weren't. There was only a handful of people with any great degree of interest in Manx culture.
Yes, so she said, and she was always stressing this, how times had changed, how in all her long lifetime her attitudes had changed tremendously. And she was always an optimist, but she always felt she had reason to be an optimist. And I remember when she thought about reviving the Cruinneach in Ramsey, I remember thinking, when she was telling us about this, well, this is a very nice idea, but who on earth is going to turn up to listen to Manx music, participate in Celtic dancing or whatever in Ramsey? I thought they'd never get more than a handful of people at the most, and they would probably all be pretty old, certainly not be wanting to jump around dancing. But Mona never let these sort of considerations get in the way. She saw it in her mind as being the necessary thing, and set about working out how it might happen, and then confidently expected it to happen, as indeed it did. And she was proved right against all sceptics and critics, including myself and lots of other people who were very friendly with her, and were very surprised at the way of her faith and optimism was justified.
I've heard tell that you were Mona's girl for a while. Is that true?
Well, Mona viewed anybody who sort of turned up fairly regularly to Glockfannon and did as Mona told her, because she was pretty bossy, as being her child or her girls or her boys. But towards the end, I think particularly, she viewed myself and my sister Jenny and Claire Stone as her girls, and woe betide if our mothers or fathers got in the way of anything that Mona wanted us to do. If she wanted us to perform in Laxey Fair and pretend to do a Manx wedding in Laxey Fair, we'd do it. Whether my father wanted us to or not, or whether my mother wanted us to do something else or not, we had to do what Mona said. And what Mona certainly taught my own mother. Now I want my girls to do this, that and the other. My mother felt a bit odd that Mona obviously considered that she was the real mother, and my mother was just a sort of caretaker, and my father was just somebody to ferry us about to various things that Mona had arranged. But as good to make expatriates, they should of course all acquiesce into this, was the general attitude. But, it amused my parents rather than irritated them. Yes, I think she did view Eglefam as a sort of surrogate family. And she liked children as far as... She liked them as far as their capacity to learn and to find out about things, and in a way they were raw material to be taught things and shown things. I don't think she particularly liked children as such. She certainly couldn't abide badly behaved children, and she had no patience for such things as children who went the wrong way in dances or didn't know their right from their left hands or couldn't listen. She had no time or patience or tolerance for children like that. But on the other hand, she was very sympathetic towards children who came from perhaps quite poor backgrounds, and she would often worry that they didn't have access to books or things to read. This really seemed to disturb her, that not the children who came weren't able to read, but were not encouraged to sort of participate in the type of things that she herself liked to do, like to read and discuss ideas and this sort of thing. And she tried to, I think in a way, she tried to sort of provide an alternative sort of lifestyle for a lot of children and show them some different things in the life that perhaps they were living when it seemed to be fairly neglected and left to just run around the streets. Yes, I think she was quite considerate and sympathetic to those sorts of things, but she's certainly very bad-tempered and irritable on other sides of things, and she could certainly make children cry. She would snap at them and burst into tears, and she wouldn't understand if the nerves or the fact that some of them didn't want to stand up and sing the solos at the guild. She'd find this extremely hard to understand how, if she taught them a song, why they wouldn't stand there and sing it. And you know, they burst into tears at last minute. She wasn't at all sympathetic to them. She thought it was ridiculous, and why didn't they get on with it? And that was a sort of no-nonsense sort of attitude that carried on all the time, and I think sometimes made it a bit difficult for people to talk easily with her, because she would be dissimilar to adults. If they appeared a bit nervous or said something a little bit silly, she would be rather snappy at them sometimes, which some people were not too keen on her because of that, I think.
And do you think, I know this is not, probably not for you to say, to speak for Mona, but do you think that she had any great political idea behind the setting up of Eglefam? Or was it, you can't separate politics and culture, but do you think it was more a cultural thing than the political thing that she was trying to do?
Well, it was a cultural thing, but I think for Mona it was more a spiritual thing in a way, because she didn't, she became to view the word politics as a rather dirty word later on in life, although all her life was spent manipulating people in rather a political way for ends that some might view as political these days. She certainly wanted to foster an air of patriotism and love of the island, a regard for old ways, a knowledge of the language, a knowledge of the songs and dances. She wanted to revive Manx culture. Perhaps she wanted to revive it to something it never actually was. In a way, I think she confused her ideals and her visions with... No, she didn't confuse her ideals and visions, but what was presented to us as Manx, authentic Manx culture, perhaps was mixed in very heavily with her ideals and visions of what she would want it to be. I think she was very heavily influenced by the sort of Celtic Twilight movements, and movements at the beginning of the century, sort of romantic Celtic nationalism. She certainly read lots of poetry, Yeats and that sort of thing, and was very heavily influenced by those sort of attitudes. And I think they carried on and coloured all her thinking. And in so much as many of the people who were involved in movements for Irish independence initially were in many ways were sort of poets and romantics in their attitudes. I think she was political in that sort of way. But she came to view the word political as being a dirty word as later on and maintained that she wasn't. This was for practical reasons too, because she was quite able to try and get her own way by conversing with all sorts of people who you'd think she might not have approved of. As she felt the greater good of getting the greater good of Manx culture would be attained, she would appear to not have too many scruples about who she would talk to or who she would invite against us, perhaps in order to get some money or interest from those people. So in a way she herself was actually quite political as far as using people perhaps as a means to an end. But her ultimate vision, I think, though, was a sort of spiritual sort of thing. She had in her mind a vision of a sort of island within an island, a sort of pure form of Manxness that probably never really existed, but towards which she would want to work, I think, where everybody would be proud and independent and in their own homes, self-sufficient, singing, dancing, generally leading a fine sort of life. She did a lot. She genuinely had a sort of vision of that, an idea that what we see now on the Isle of Man is just sort of scratching of the surface, and that somehow the reality exists underneath this layer of reality. And if you sort of tap into a certain kind of spiritual energy, you can reach the sort of hidden layer of Manxness. I think this sort of thing, she wouldn't talk about that much, but came through in her poetry and her plays, this sort of belief.
Well, on a different subject altogether, well, not entirely different, can you tell me a little bit about the beginning of the Cruinniach and what Mona was thinking on that? What are your memories of the beginning of the Cruinniach? What Mona was doing, what various people were doing?
I can't remember the first year the Cruinniach began exactly, though I think it was a one day thing in Ramsey, I think it was 1978. Not sure really, because of course I was away from the island quite a bit at those times because I was at university from 1977 onwards. I believe there's 1 and 2 day sort of festivals with a concert, I think. I've certainly participated in play at a certain concert in the first 2 or 3 years of the Cruinniach. That was in Ramsey Grammar School. It just had a sort of concert with various people doing different turns. But in all honesty, I can't remember that much about it. So I think I missed quite a few being away. About the days.
Tell me a bit more about the plays then. The plays that Mona wrote that you performed in.
Oh, well. Mona was a great one for the plays of different sorts. And I think in a way I enjoyed very much being part of these. We've mentioned before that we do concert parties. Well, Mona would also, as well as harassing and bullying children into doing various things. She would do the same with various adults. And she could always be relied upon to get together a group of people to put on a few dialect plays. And many's a dialect play I've been in. I usually was the token child. I never had very exciting parts. But I remember very, very many people involved in all these dialect plays. And they were the cast who always seemed to be picked for their unsuitability for the part, which always caused great mirth. There was always in these plays a returned young Manx American, always played by somebody who was at least 70. Frequently was the bright young woman, who was often played by somebody about 60. There seemed to be the requisite the necessity for them. Switch the thing off.
So, you've told me a bit about Mona Douglas. You were saying that you learned a bit of Manx from Lewis Crellin. Could you tell me a little bit about Lewis? When did you first meet Lewis?
Yes. I met Lewis the first time when I was probably about 9 or 10. Lewis Crellin was probably in the 70s then. The mop of white hair. My mother and father took to go into a Manx class in Peel at one time, and I would go along with them too sometimes. I remember being held in the Rechabite Hall in Peel, which is some stone steps near the promenade. Lewis would have a group of people gathered round him, four or five people, and they would be reading through his stories, which were in Manx, and translating them all the other way round. He had a great love of Peel and of the surrounding areas, Foxdale and Patrick and all around there, and he had lots of stories that he'd heard of. Things he'd seen himself, often about themselves or some queer goings on somewhere or other. Anything odd that was going on, Lewis seems to have heard about it. And he'd a great way of telling these stories in the Manx that really made your blood run cold. He would be sitting in this very dark room huddled round Lewis, and he would be telling the story in tones of doom. And then, at the end of every time, you'd say, "Oh, but the Manx is dying, it's dying." And everybody would say, "Oh no, it isn't, Lewis, oh no, it isn't, not while we're alive." My mother used to reckon this was his way of keeping the interest going. He did seem, despite of having a large sort of streak of pessimism, he still kept going, teaching Manx, and against all the odds, against everything that he said about it himself. Still couldn't stop doing it.
Interesting. And how long were you going to those lessons with Lewis?
Periodically, over a few years. I didn't participate as fully as I might have done. I was mainly listening, as I felt nervous with being with a lot of adults. Though, if I'd known, was probably as good or as bad as any of them themselves.
As Cúin Cúisiú Tadhg the Ginsaga Gilg, the Lord Gilg, Cat.
Oh, and I'll be Jinn of Shen first. Well, for the the quite blend now the Hennish. The Mayvili I Gilg is Gestach Visha Gilg is Gordoren Os Gilg Vishimadi Blenden. Ach,
and then me ve ons boiled red with slyelia the art guild as you had some an on ish ach nish tam ach hergin o twin a care tam ach hergin the art guild as pain as a genuine begin.
As good to swing it and look around, and Gil goes to tread a hit, he was swing it and beg and then.
Well, and now for Sim, Shin, for the BA on.
As to Mac going. Touching someone if they're lucky and it's like a guild day. Couldn't fair.
Well, take on a loud nail in this. Tan Chenya, Alien, the Alien. Chenya. Rufus a chreigio. Ys ty sy'n cwmwl yn sgwini eich. Nach fel sy'n bwyl ddyddio o gilg.
Ti wedi o. Ti. Creig nis spot na hais o'n sy'n. Fel ti ski. Shin and Jenna. Well, go to my Mario, Annie. Go to my Morid. Some and Kush. That's only and Fiss. We in a Fogle and Krina. Kurt Dun. North. That's
Abishin.
An Abishin. That's, well, go to my home.